This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com. It used to be so easy. Rembrandt painted art, so did Da Vinci, Botticelli, Rubens, Constable, Vermeer. Beautiful paintings were art, no argument. But then came Marcel Duchamp and what he called fountain, a urinal, a so-called ready-made, which appeared in a 1917 show. In more recent times, British artist Tracy Emin exhibited an unmade bed. Damien Hirst immersed a tiger shark in formaldehyde. Are these art? It seems absurd to deny that they are, since they were exchanged for eye-watering sums of money and were displayed in respected art galleries. But if so, were they art merely because they were somehow linked to the art world and because the art world deemed them art? Is that good enough? Not according to Derek Matravers of the Open University, author of Art and Emotion.
Derek Matravers, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thanks, it's nice to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on today is the definition of art. The definition of art has a history. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of background on where the idea of art came from in the first place.
Well, the fine arts as we now know them, which are things like painting and sculpture and music, prior to about the 1740s, they were scattered conceptually. So, for example, music was often linked to mathematics. What we now know as the fine arts were linked to engineering, or the equivalent of engineering those days. Then in the 1740s, a French thinker called the Abbé Batteau had this idea that you could group these things together as the fine arts. And that's where we get our modern concept of the art from.
So you're saying one person almost single-handedly invented art?
Yes. You need to think about the context at the time. What's recognised as the first novel, Pamela, by Richardson, had only been published, I think, about 6 years before. The Enlightenment was going in full swing. People had more leisure time. So it was a time of great conceptual innovation anyway. So somebody was going to do it. So I think it wasn't just a single man sitting in his office. It was a current of the time.
Now, there are obviously things which we would call art that pre-existed this time. So what we're saying is conceptually they weren't grouped together. What was it that allowed this guy to group them together? What was the essence of art for him?
He came up with two things. First, he said, and I think this was probably a mistake, that art is the imitation of nature, because there's plenty of things that even he thought of as the fine arts that just don't fit that. But the main idea he had was that these things were a cause of pleasure, caused in the audience states which they could enjoy for their own sake. The name he gave to that was pleasure.
Let's focus on the visual arts, because that's simpler, and we can follow that through to the 20th and 21st centuries. With the visual arts, it's not absurd to think of the 18th century visual arts as being representations which have aesthetic beauty.
That's right, and beauty comes into it very quickly. For fairly obvious reasons, pleasure turns out to be a rather inadequate characterization of the mental state to which these fine arts give rise. So we take pleasure in having hot showers and sucking toffees and things, and you sort of think that the mental state involved with the arts is more complicated than that. And the great German Enlightenment philosopher, Immanuel Kant, wrote three great books of philosophy, and the third book, The Critique of Judgment, gave a much more complicated and nuanced account of what the mental state that arises from our perceptions of beauty is. So we got two things there. We got a complicated mental state, which is connected with pleasure, but sort of more complicated than pleasure, and a new word to name those things in the world that cause this mental state. Beauty wasn't a new word, of course, but the link was new. So beautiful objects were objects that caused this complicated mental state, this aesthetic experience.
And for Kant, there was a strong formal element in the sense that the patterns of shapes and lines were what determined whether something was beautiful or not.
That's right. What he thought was that it's absurd to say this is beautiful for me. You can say I like it, but if you're claiming that an object is beautiful, then what you're doing is you're at least asking other people to agree with you. So he had a problem then, because on the one hand, beauty was linked with pleasure. However, we're our own best judges about what gives us pleasure. So Kant had this problem that he wanted to say that the judgments of beauty were universal, everybody ought to go with them. On the other hand, the account simply in terms of pleasure made them very individual. So what he did, in this very simple thought, was to take out of the judgment of beauty anything that might pertain to anybody as an individual and focus on those things which everybody could see in common, namely the form. So he abstracted out colour, because you might prefer red and I might prefer green. He abstracted out everything except this formal element in order to get to universal judgments.
So let's fast forward to the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th, when there was a strong move in the visual arts towards abstraction, moving away from this idea of representing nature as it is, the emphasis on the brushstrokes gradually moving towards a total abstraction which didn't relate directly to anything visual in the world. Also, another aspect of that is Marcel Duchamp's ready-mades, where he actually found existing objects and placed them in galleries, and these were recognised as works of art. How can the traditional aesthetic approach to art, art as beauty, cope with these cases?
You're quite right. There was a crisis, and it's normally dated to about 1912, 1914. And there are various accounts of what caused this crisis. One of them is that if we go back to the idea of visual arts representing the world, well, lo and behold, photography and movies turn up that can represent the world a whole lot better, so art goes into a crisis. I think an element of that is true, but I don't really believe that for the reason that I don't think that artists prior to 1914 thought of their primary job as representing the world. But certainly there was a break from beauty, so these objects were being included in the world of the arts that were not beautiful, and the definition of art either had to be abandoned or expanded in order to accommodate these new objects.
It's almost as if some artists, particularly Duchamp, were deliberately attacking a past conception of what art had been.
Yes, that's right. The term that describes the intellectual current of the time was modernism. And again, like the Enlightenment, it was a huge revolution in thought, and there were huge changes in art, as in a lot of other things.
Coming back to the philosophy, though, how do we cope with this change? Can we give an adequate definition of art that encompasses both traditional art, visual art of the 18th century and afterwards, and the radical new kinds of art of the 20th and 21st century?
Well, a couple of philosophers, Arthur Danto and George Dickey, both American philosophers, came up with a rather neat idea to think of objects that were works of art as things that were linked to a particular social practice. So you look out into the car park and there's, I don't know why a picture will be in the car park, but say there's a picture there, somebody holding a picture, and there's a beautiful Japanese motorbike. Well, they're both beautiful objects, but what makes the picture a work of art is that it's linked to the art world and the motorbike is not linked to the art world. So these social links came to define art.
I think it's important to get clear here about what the art world means in this context. It's not just those people who happen to work in galleries, who have power in institutions in that sense. For Dickey, certainly, it's a much wider category, so that anybody who thinks they're a member of the art world automatically are. So anyone who wants to be an artist is, by that fact, a member of the art world.
Yes. Different people had different things to say about what exactly they meant by the art world. You're quite right that Dickey's definition was extraordinarily wide. I think that the definition that Gerald Levinson comes up with, which is just to think of it as the historical tradition of making art, is probably a better institution to use as the one to which to link the objects.
Let's take the example of Duchamp's fountain. And all it was a factory-produced urinal. Now, how could that be a work of art? Although the original has been lost, Duchamp made some authenticated copies, which are now in Tate Modern, the Beaubourg Centre, and various places around the world. How can those be works of art?
Well, the difference between Duchamp's urinal and a commoner garden urinal is that Duchamp linked his urinal to the art world, and that's what makes it a work of art. So to take George Dickey's definition, something is a work of art if, firstly, it's an artefact, and secondly, some person or persons acting on behalf of the art world has put it forward as a candidate for appreciation. And so what we can see here is Duchamp putting this urinal forward as a candidate for appreciation, and that's what makes this urinal art and the other urinals not art.
And yet you've got some worries about the institutional theory, at least in the simple terms that we've discussed it.
Yes, well, Richard Volheim, who was a prominent British aesthetician of the last half of the last century, came up with a dilemma for the institutional theory. He said, well, either people have reasons for putting these objects forward as art, or they don't. And if they have reasons, it's the reasons we should be interested in, because those are what makes it art. And if they don't have reasons, then we've got an entirely uninteresting theory, because all we'd have would be some arbitrary collection of objects. This dilemma did seem to stymie the institutional theory for a while, and I think is still widely thought to have refuted the theory. But I'm not sure that the dilemma really works. Go back to one of Dickey's earliest analogies. What's the difference between a married person and a not married person? Well, it's going to be no difference in their physical constitution. What it is that one of them has been through a process, so Dickey similarly says, same with works of art. One of them has been through this kind of institutionalized process. But although it's true that there's no single reason which will explain why everybody who is married, people get married for different reasons, It is nonetheless true that for everybody who is married, there's some reason why they got married. And I think that's what the institutionalists sort of said to Vollheim. Fine, there's no single reason such that anything that's been put forward as a work of art has been put forward. But for each object, there'll be some reason or other why it, rather than some other object, has been put forward.
So you're saying that some ready-made could be selected because it's beautiful or because it seems to be an ironic comment on capitalist society. There could be any range of reasons why any particular work was within a gallery.
Yes, the good thing about this thought is that you can incorporate all the reasons in the past. So you can say, well, Rembrandt's paintings are works of art, and the reason they're works of art is that they're paintings. Duchamp's urinal is a work of art, and the reason it's a work of art is because of some mental act or some act of conferral that Duchamp did. What you're saying is something like this. This is a work of art because, and then you give a reason. Which reasons? Well, whatever reasons happen to be operative in the art world at the time. So take some of the reasons we have now. And it seems, building on the legacy of Duchamp, that there are artists, and I've heard Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst, two modern British artists, say this in interviews, who think that as they're artists, their word is enough to make something a work of art. So you say to them, well, why is this a work of art? And they say, I'm an artist, and I've just laid hands on it and made it a work of art. Now that seems to me to be a reason currently operative in the art world. In my opinion, that reason is not defensible. I think that's just a bit of cultural silliness we have.
So you're rejecting this idea of artists having the Midas touch, and what you're replacing it with is a notion that there have to be reasons for choices to make these things works of art. But who's to judge which reasons count?
That, I think, is the crucial question, because in a way what we get here is the revenge of Richard Vollheim, because Vollheim's initial accusation was that at least if they adopt one of the forks, the institutional theorist just ends up with an arbitrary collection of objects. Well, if they follow my line, they're able to defeat that, but what they end up is a collection of objects for what I'm sure Vollheim would have said an arbitrary collection of reasons, because what still makes it institutional is that the reasons that we appeal to are just the reasons currently operative in the art world. I think philosophers should get in there and dispute the reasons that are operative in the art world. The art world gets away with not defending those reasons.
And do you think that that would lead to clearer evaluations of the relative merits of artworks?
Yes, I think it would. We do need to get back to a position where people can tell stories about why they're interested in particular works of art that are convincing in the following respect, that they will convince people to spend time engaging with it and get some kind of rich experience out of it. For example, I don't know if you've ever settled down to work out how many free Saturday afternoons you have left in the rest of your life. Once you get to my middle age, it's a really rather small number, an alarmingly small number. Now, if we're going to take one of those Saturday afternoons and spend it in an art gallery, then some story needs to be told about why that's a worthwhile use of that time.
Derek McTravers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can hear more Philosophy Bites at www.philosophybites.com.